If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi folks, how you doing? It's Friday. Well, it'll be Friday when you're listening to this. I hope you've had a good week. Hope you've managed to visit a cinema. There is so much around at the minute as well. So I hope you've had a chance to pop in and spend a little time on your own or with some friends or a loved one in front of a big screen and immerse yourself in incredible storytelling. My mum and dad, I spoke to them last night and they went along to a new little cinema that's reopened in St Andrews, my hometown. Well, near my hometown anyway. And they went along to see the Bruce Springsteen film, Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere. They loved it. So I had a really nice conversation with them about that last night. I love that. I love when you or someone comes out of the cinema and they want to have a conversation about it. So yeah, I hope you've been able to do that yourself. We have something for the weekend, this fine Friday for you on Soundtrackin', as we have not one, but two very special episodes with two very special gentlemen, both returning to Soundtrackin', I'm proud to say. First up, Edgar Wright, who is back for, I think, the fourth time to discuss his take on Stephen King's novel, The Running Man. Then we are going to drop a conversation with none other than Johnny Greenwood. I know, pinch me. I was actually on my way into a cinema, the Battersea Power Station Cinema, to host a Q&A with Chase Infinity, who plays Willa in One Battle After Another. And as I was going up the escalator, I was just checking my emails, never off, and in my inbox popped an email from Johnny Greenwood. Literally nearly fell off the escalator. And he emailed me on Monday to say that he had a little window of time between Radiohead duties to have a chat about his latest collaboration with Paul Thomas Anderson on One Battle After Another. So I'm really excited to share that with you a little bit later on. So that'll be coming in the next hour or so maybe. But now it is Edgar's time. Starring Glenn Powell, The Running Man tells the story of Ben Richards' appearance on the top-rated TV show of the same name. Deadly competition where contestants must survive 30 days whilst being hunted by professional assassins. This is very consciously not a remake of the 1987 movie. Instead, is much more faithful to Stephen King's novel. You'll hear Edgar talk about that in detail about when he first read the book, but also it's not completely shying away from the film in that there are a couple of really brilliant little kind of nods and Easter eggs in the film. In particular, I'm just going to tell you, money with Arnold Schwarzenegger's face on it, which is brilliant. The Running Man is scored by Stephen Price, but we're going to kick off with a needle drop that opens the film. And I've got a really fun story about that before we hear it. This track, as I say, opens the film pretty much. It's in one of the early scenes anyway. And I was lucky enough, in fact, this time last year, I was in Scotland hosting the Scottish BAFTAs, which I'm doing again this weekend. Good luck, everybody. And someone said to me when I checked into the hotel, Edgar's in town filming Running Man. I was like, no way. So I messaged him and he said, oh, message Leo and pop down and say hi. So Leo is his long-term producer. So I arrived on set and they were filming. When you go and see the film, which if you haven't already, it came out in cinemas yesterday, there is a scene where Glenn's character, Ben, is like, he leaves the house, he's on a mission, he's pulled his, he's off, you know, he's on this mission. He pulls up his hoodie and he's like walking down the street. I watched that being filmed. It was amazing. Loads of extras. And it was kind of that thing where Glenn walked to the music, which was being blasted out on the streets of Glasgow. And then it's like, okay, cut, reset. I must have watched it being done about 20 times. And then what was amazing when I left set is that there were other kind of streets in and around where they were filming that were obviously being prepared and being dressed to film little bits and bobs. And I talked to Edgar about that kind of choice to be in real environments as opposed to taking an easy option and being on a lot and keeping it locked down. And because, you know, there's people taking pictures on the street and all that kind of stuff as well. So it's hard to keep things private and a surprise and suspenseful when you do make that choice to shoot on location. But he has, and it adds so much to the film. Anyway, as I said, whilst he was filming that, he was blasting this track, Underdog by Sly and the Family Stone.
Hey, this! I do high speeds to expect to get a fair shake, but they won't let you forget that you're an underdog and you got to be twice as good. Yeah, yeah! Even if you're never right, they get uptight when you got to right, or you might start thinking too much. Yeah, yeah, yeah! I do high speeds when you know you're real, but every other time,
last year, about this time, I popped down to see you on the streets of Glasgow.
Oh, that's right.
Do you remember? Yeah.
I had forgotten about that. Of course, yeah.
And I was like, oh, when I saw it in the film as well, the walk. I was like, I saw that.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You came down to the bit when he's walking out of his apartment right at the start.
Yeah.
Like, literally the first shot of the opening credits, right?
And you had the music blasting that day.
That's right.
Which was so nice to see because you kind of feel the swagger and the energy and the kind of like, it helps, doesn't it?
It's probably one of the only, well, no, there's a few scenes in the movie where we're playing the music. Like, probably not in other bits playing, like, needle drops. Definitely playing score, because, like, there's obviously things, like, later there's the dancers on stage dancing to the theme tune, and the theme tune itself, or the theme tune to Speed the Wheel, all of the TV stuff. I think probably the Sly and the Family Stone song was probably the only thing that we played on set, because Glenn is sort of kind of walking in time. Mm-hmm. I was watching, I said the other day, I said, you only need, like, a paint pot in your hand, and it's the start of Saturday Night Fever. You know, we're so close to Saturday Night Fever right now.
That I would like to see, that hybrid of Running Man, Saturday Night Fever. That would be amazing. It was really interesting hearing you talk about, I was watching you some interviews, we were talking about the sort of genesis of this journey where you, I don't know if it was a kind of, if you meant it when you tweeted out about this being the film that you wanted to make, or it was just kind of a slightly kind of, this is what's in my head now and I'll put it out there.
I'd answered that question over the years because it's like one of those questions that comes up. It's sort of like the second question after, would you ever make a Star Wars movie? So it's like, would you ever remake, you know, if you remade any film, what would you remake? And the reason I said The Running Man, and let me be clear, is like, I didn't want to remake the 1987 film because that exists and it's its own thing and it's like sort of super fun. But I had read the book when I was a teenager and I knew the book was wildly different. And even as a teenager reading the book, also I read the book before I saw the 1987 film because that came out in 1988 in the UK and it was in 18. So I didn't see it in the cinema. I saw it on video maybe a couple of years later. I'd read the book by then and obviously, when you're reading a book, you visualize that movie. And then when you see the other movie, it's a completely different thing. I was like, huh, okay. So it stuck in my head for decades that there was a whole other movie in Stephen King's novel.
Yeah.
And this is what we wanted to do. So I'd answered that question over the years. And I think because I had put it out in the ether that Simon Kinberg, one of the producers, 4 years ago, not that long ago, emailed me and said, hey, is it true you have an interest in The Running Man? We have the rights. Is this something you'd like to work on? I was like, yes. Like, send. Only the easiest email of all time. But it's very rare that something that you really, really want to do turns up in your inbox. I can't think of another instance of that.
And then I guess then the book was your jumping off point, as you know, in terms of like using that as your kind of reference point. But do you have to get kind of like blessing from Stephen King once you've kind of written it, or what, through the process?
Yes. I mean, he's a producer on it. And so part of that is that, you know, he gets to sign off on the adaptation. I had been in contact with him over the years because he'd always been really generous about my previous movies. And obviously, I'm a huge fan. But when I used to read email, it was a sort of just a sort of like a, you know, kind of like pen pals or something. But we mostly just talk about music. And it turned into this tradition of me sending him rock music on his birthday of bands that I thought he might not previously be aware of. So,
like
King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard said, I think you'll like this. Or like Sunflower Bean, or like I'm sure he probably knew the Hives already, but just like stuff like more like sort of, because I knew he was like a big Ramones fan and he loves kind of rock and AC/DC and the Stones. And it's like I'd send him sort of more recent stuff that I thought he'd enjoy. So we had this kind of correspondence. In terms of when I was working on the film, I didn't send him the script until quite late because I wanted to make sure it was definitely happening in the movie, to engage with him about the project. And if it fell apart, it would be too heartbreaking.
So
I didn't want to be like the boy who cried wolf. I didn't send him the script until I thought, it feels like it's going to go. And this was only like a year and a bit ago, maybe like last summer or something like that in 2024. So it was a funny then to send an email saying, as I know you are probably aware, I have been working with Michael Bacall on the screenplay. So that's when he read the screenplay.
I don't know, was there something that was important for you to have his, not guidance, but opinion on?
Yeah, I mean, I think because it's both very faithful to the book, and also there are some changes, and obviously you want to like know how he feels about it, but he really loved it, and he thought what we did, and you know, even in terms of the ending, he really liked it, which was great. So that's amazing, but that's a sort of blessing and a curse to kind of get those kudos from him so early.
Yeah.
Because now you still have to make the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ambition level of the movie is kind of set by yourself. And when you're making a movie, you're always trying to live up to the movie that's in your head. And now I was having to live up to the movie that was in his head as well. Mm-hmm. So I felt sort of like just like putting a lot of pressure on myself. But you kind of sort of thinking throughout the production is like, can't let Stephen King down now. Like so yeah.
I was lucky enough to chat to Stephen Price. Now, when would that have been? About, must have been in the summer actually, and he was like deep in the world. But I imagine that would have been the second phase, like you talked about, because the role of him in creating music, original music for the film, you know, there's the score, the obvious part of it, but there is so much kind of diegetic music within the film. In and around those brilliant kind of game shows, the adverts on the telly,
reality shows,
all that kind of thing that's kind of going on as well. So when you're writing the script and you're writing your version of things in around that area, are you writing ideas for music on that, or is that just conversations that you have with him about what you need for, you know, I'm sorry, I can't remember the names of everything because I've just saw it yesterday. But, you know, the Sean Hayes show, you know.
Yeah, Speed the Wheel. Speed,
which is like the most genius bit of casting in that as well. He's having so much fun in that kind of, in that game show host role. But yeah, in terms of, you know, talking to him about what you needed, because...
Well, I mean, I think not at a writing stage. I mean, Steve obviously is like my fourth film with him. So the great thing with Steve is that he responds to the script and the sort of the vibe, or even like... In a way, like, there's not, in a good way, there's not a lot of conversation because I think we know each other really well.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple of things. It's like, there are the sort of needle drops that are in the film, some of which I got to give credit to Michael Bacall. There were a couple of needle drops that were in the, we worked on the treatment together, and then he did the first draft, and the first draft had like the Sly and the Family Stone song in it and the Stones one, and it's like, great. I love both those songs and amazing. I was amazed to find that like Heartbreaker by the Rolling Stones had never been in a movie before. I actually checked on IMDb. You know, you do that thing. I do that thing all the time where you put like artist and then you just look at every single time it's been in the film, which obviously with the Stones,
especially
it's like 700 movies.
Yeah.
50 of the Martin Scorsese movies. But like, and it's like, wow, Heartbreak has never been in the movie. That's crazy.
I mean, that's an achievement, I think.
No, it's good because I kind of, I almost swore I'd felt it in another movie. So I was like, oh, is it, are we going to be the first movie to use this song, really?
The police in New York City. They chased a boy right through the park. In a place of mistaken identity. They put a bullet through his heart.
In terms of Steve, it's like, this factors in. When we were writing, working on the script, two scores that we'd listen to all the time would be John Carpenter's Escape from New York score with Alan Howarth, and also Jerry Goldsmith's score for Logan's Run.
Amazing.
Particularly the track called The Dome, you know, with the kind of sort of early synths and stuff. So we sort of, that's the thing we'd write to get us in the mood. I mentioned that to Steve, but he definitely picked up the same sort of vibe from the script. And what Steve did, which is amazing, is he wrote a whole bunch of cues just based on the script alone.
Wow.
And so we had, like, here are some ideas, like six kind of suites. And most of that is in the movie. Obviously, he kind of adapts it to sort of fit picture, but it's like, these are the themes. So when we were, as well as when you came down and we were playing Sly and the Family Stone at full volume in Glasgow, We had some score that we could play.
Great.
You know, just for sort of like tension and tone. And then on top of that, like you said, then like Steve has to do all the other incidental music for the shows, which is, and he said to me last night, or he was saying to somebody, like, it was disturbing how much he enjoyed doing the game show stuff.
Great.
So Hans Zimmer did do the theme tune for Going for Gold. You knew that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I knew that. There's quite a few of them as well when you kind of go back in the sort of early days where they've kind of, you know, where they've had to make the money to do the things that they want to do. And it's kind of like, whoa. I mean, that's a good theme tune going for gold. But
when Hans Zimmer does his big rock concerts between like Dunkirk and
Inception.
The Dark Knight, do you think he does Going for Gold?
Going for gold. Yeah, so always, yeah. But even when you think back to that, I mean, you know, looking back at the previous film and who and what was involved in that, Harold Faltermeyer, you know, in terms of the score in that. And I don't know how I didn't know that Starsky was the director of that film, which kind of blew my little Scottish mind.
He was like, actually, whoa. Like, I mean, it's interesting. I think that, and you know, that sounds like such a name dropper, but me and Glenn had the occasion to talk to Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he said, it's interesting, because that film, I think, had a slightly troubled production in that the first director was fired and Paul Glaser was the replacement. And the original director, who I think shot for a couple of weeks, was Andrew Davis, who directed The Fugitive. So it's quite funny to me that on The Running Man, it's like, you lost the director of The Fugitive.
Yeah. Wow.
But so I think it was somewhat Paul Glaser, Starsky, did direct the 1987 film. The other thing as well, Harold Faltermeyer, the thing that I, you know, this is very much a new adaptation of the book. And I say the few things that the nods to the 1987 film is there's a reference to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Which is great, by the way.
The lifts, we didn't want to do the same thing as the 1987 film, but we did our sort of own version with these kind of single man lifts, like the kind of, you know, those things, have you ever seen those lifts that you get in car parks, the sort of valet lift? They look terrifying.
Okay. It reminded me of like a flume.
Well, they have those lifts in... I've only seen them in the States.
You've got some really posh places, that's why.
No. It's a valet lift. It's actually kind of, like, terrifying.
Oh,
like
wow.
The backs, like, in car parks, they have the lift with
just
no...
Just for the valet.
With no, like, it's a man lift, and it has no kind of, like, shaft, so you have to get on. So if you poked your head out, you'd shear it straight off. So I was thinking, oh, it's like those lifts that you get for, like, the valets in the back of the car park. Why did I bring that up? Oh, that was the other reference. And then the third thing was, like, we should have dancers at the start of the show. And that wasn't in the script, but it was like just as a nod to the 87 film. Who was the choreographer on the original film of that sequence?
I have no idea.
Paula Abdul.
Shut up.
True. I think, in fact, that cue by Harold Faltermeyer, I think it's called like Paula's Dance. So when I was working with Jen White on the dancers, I said, this is our Paula Abdul moment.
But I love what it made me feel was like you're... love of music and your appreciation of music as part of storytelling is so obvious and beautifully celebrated in your films. And every film has got a different kind of journey and texture with the music and stuff. But I watched that particular and like, when is he going to do a full on musical?
I know. It was funny. People keep asking me that, but it's also like, you want to make sure that the audience is there. Like I
already.
Say that. Well, it's difficult. I remember people kept asking me about that when I was promoting Soho, and it was sort of the year 2021 was the year that there were like five big musicals and none of them did well. So I was like, is there, I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, I guess that was before Wicked though.
Yeah.
That was before Wicked. That was pre-Wicked. I guess it was COVID time. So no movies did well.
Yeah. Another Stephen King adaptation. He can get involved and help with the music as well, with his love of music. So, I mean, there's got to be something there. I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to talk about the rest of the movie.
My favorite scene in a Stephen King film is a sort of musical scene, because one of my favorite Stephen King adaptation is Carrie.
Yeah.
And my favorite scene is the prom. I say the prom scene, but the lead up to the Bucket of Blood.
Yeah.
The Pino Donaggio cue, which is called Bucket of Blood, is so fantastic and so operatic, and it's just to me is like pitch perfect cinema of that cue and the slow motion shot of them going up on stage and the camera going past the rope up to the bucket, and that Pino Donaggio cue is incredible.
Oh, it's that way where it's part of the story, it's help telling the story in such a beautiful and specific way.
But it's also the match of the composer and the director. The Pino Donaggio totally gets how operatic Brian De Palma is. That it's like big and it can be operatic and that's okay. And the slow motion, and it's like sort of, and the music is so sort of like emotional, even melodramatic, but in a way that just totally hits the bullseye.
Yeah.
Thank you.
When did you know, or when do you know when to use a needle drop and when to use score in this? Because, you know, you've got, you mentioned the Sly and the Family Stone, you've got Gil Scott-Heron in there as well. We got
the second movie this year to use, Revolution Will Not Be Televised. Actually, when one battle after another was coming out, Paul Thomas Anderson's not on Instagram, but Mike DeLuca, the head of Warner Brothers, is, and he kept putting that on all of the premiere things, and I hadn't seen the film yet, so I emailed him and said, hey, can I ask you a question about Paul's movie? Is The Revolution Will Not Be Televised? And he says, yes, it's on the end credits, and it's a motif throughout the movie. I was like, yeah, fuck. I said, well, it's in our movie as well. Oh, well. I guess 2025 is if any year, any calendar year would have The Revolution Will Not Be Televised twice, yes, it would be 2025.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised.
And 2025 has a relevance to this story as well, which is crazy.
Stephen King set the book, published in 1982, but written in 1972. And I asked him, I said, why did you pick 2025? And he said, it sounded like a cool year. And it was also a ways off. So to go back to your thing about needle drops, yeah, though, is that I think it was some that were in the script. There's some that sort of came later in terms of, like, in production. Like, I've always loved the song He's Gonna Step On You Again by John Congers, which I think when some people listen to it, it's one of those songs that, like, I know as a sort of, like, as a fan of older music, even, like, sort of glam rocky, but people are like, wait, the Happy Monday song is a cover version? What? Yeah. It blows their mind.
Totally.
Like the thought, wait, Step On is a cover version? Yeah. And then to hear the original song is like, oh, wow, okay. So I was really happy to get that. Coffee Cold by Galt McDermott, and we needed a sort of little spot for that. I mean, there are other things that were sort of in there, and there are other things that kind of were in there and came out, like, and we actually, you know, probably more than previous ones, kind of tried something in there that was really, well, at one point we had, I was sad to lose because it made my girlfriend smile, Native New Yorker by Odyssey.
Oh, wow.
But that's for another time.
Oh, yeah.
But it was, but it, you know what?
I'm trying to imagine where you put it now.
It was in the bit where he crosses the street in Times Square. And we changed it back to Steve's score, which was more suspenseful, which was the right call. But I did for that brief moment where, like, sort of Odyssey was in there. I was like, yes. But then, you know, the good thing is like, sort of, it actually was a film where you had the options to modulate the tone.
Yeah.
And you could tell that with an audience. Like, sort of, where a needle drop is really working, or like, no, this should be a score bit.
Yeah.
And it was something like, we tried that song and it was funny, but then maybe it wasn't the right place to be funny. Mm. Let's go back to the suspenseful score. And it was just like, okay, that's better.
Save it for your musical.
I just listened to it at home.
But also holding back from that kind of, you know, leaning into too many running songs. You know,
yes.
In terms of, that's kind of, you know, there's obviously the Tom Jones.
What's funny about that, mm-hmm, is I actually thought in my head, we're not using Keep On Running by Spencer Davis Group.
Yeah.
It's too obvious. And it was one of those songs like I Feel Good by James Brown that was in every trailer ever.
Yeah.
And what's funny is we did originally have a different song at the end. And when we were like doing some post about shooting, you know, it is what's funny. All the other running songs I use on my Instagram, or I put a lot of them are in the sort of pre like screening like playlists and stuff. It's like all of the other sort of like running songs can go there. But the Tom Jones cover, I had heard that before, and I heard it again, and I was like, oh wow, this is a really good cover. It's really good arrangement. It's got real that brass. It's got real swagger. Again, never used in a movie, and I played it to Glenn. And he goes, oh, he goes, that's badass. And I was literally about to use an Instagram story for the film with that. And I was like, wait. And I was like, I didn't do it. I said, wait,
save it.
This might be useful later. Don't put that on Instagram. So I stopped myself. And then it was like later, it's like, you know what? This is the perfect song. This is the perfect song. So I'm really glad that was in there.
Yeah, it really was.
Keep on running. Keep on high. One fine day I gotta be the one to make you understand. Oh yes, I gotta be your man. I'll keep on running, running from my arms. One fine day I gotta be the one to make you understand. Oh, baby, I gotta be your man. Everybody's talking about me. It makes me feel so bad. Everyone is laughing at me. It makes me feel so sad. So keep on running.
Glenn's performance is brilliant.
Oh,
the kind of
you.
Arc of this character is absolutely fantastic. How much of a collaborator was he? You know, as you talk about him, you know, kind of this song and as an example. But yeah,
he's amazing. I can say enough nice things about Glenn. He's just incredible. I mean, and no diss on previous leading men, because obviously like Simon and Michael Cera and Ansel, all that amazing. Like, but this great thing with something like Glenn, he's got that thing where like he just wants it to be as good as you do,
yeah.
You know, and like sort of having those actors, and I've been lucky to work with many people like this that just like want to work hard, want to give it their all. Like Glenn's like sort of so kind of like in it to win it, just like, I mean, he's such a great actor and he can sort of do everything. And the thing that I think was really good for me in this was like, he's so charming and funny and relatable and has that great everyman quality, which is another key aspect of the book that we wanted to bring into this. But for him to bring out like a sort of a more intense, furious edge, and sort of like with somebody as nice as Glenn, for me and Michael Bacall, sort of creating the scenarios where like Glenn Powell's going to lose his shit, it's sort of like delicious to us. It's like you kind of like sort of like, because it's also, it's why he's on the game show. There's a sort of key scene early on when he's kind of at the registration booth for the game, and the guy behind the counter is being sort of like extremely passive aggressive.
Yeah.
But the reason he's doing that is because he wants these people to have a temper tantrum, because there are people watching.
Yeah.
And like in a reality show where they're sort of like on, you know, backstage, and then when there's the worst singer, it's like that person. You know, it's like they're sort of saying him.
Yeah.
But as soon as he kind of like flips out and breaks the glass, it's like send him straight up.
Yeah.
It's like this guy's good TV. So it's the thing about the character that's really key is he has a lot of like righteous anger, and he's somebody who has been punished for doing the right thing and held back and penalized in this kind of cruel world. Things that you should do, stand up for yourself and others, like tell bullies where to go. But in this kind of like, you know, cruel dystopia, you know, you're going to be like punished for it.
Yeah.
So it's something about him. It's kind of, you know, the righteous anger is something that to be proud of, but of course then it's the thing that makes him the prime candidate to be on the show.
Yeah.
But to sort of like take somebody as nice as Glenn and we used to call it like Glenn hulking out.
I like that. Cera as well, Michael Cera. It's I mean that, yeah, the water pistol scene's just absolutely delicious. I was proper belly laughing at that. I just love watching him on screen. He's not on screen enough.
He's great. I mean, I just like, what a sort of like joy to kind of work with him again. And such a sort of like, and also to sort of, he's a great dramatic actor, Michael, as well. And so that's what I really love about this performance, is like the sort of like, you know, I remember when we did the first like test screening of the movie, where people are watching it completely blind. It was amazing to see an audience start to realize it was Michael Cera, because it took them a few sort of like seconds to sort of like who they're looking at.
Yeah,
and, you know, and I won't spoil it. No, I shouldn't spoil it. But there's a sort of key moment that I think my people like Michael Cera in the movie so much that when a certain moment happens, everybody goes, "No!"
Yeah.
Like in unison, which yeah. is like makes me very, as a sort of like the kind of like the cruel puppet master, I get.
Yeah, there's a prequel there for the mum and son character and that journey for sure.
Sandra Dickinson.
Oh my God.
Amazing.
Just brilliant.
Loved working with her as well.
Oh my God, so great. Josh Brolin as well. I mean, the words I want to use to describe that character, but just, I mean, again, you can just see he's having so much fun in the kind of devilish, suave kind of nature of that character. It's brilliant.
We talked about this. It's like the worst, most ruthless people in, not just in media, in business, will come on like they're your best friend.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't like need, I mean, even though he's wearing the veneers, he doesn't need as a character to show teeth, because he never really needs to raise his voice. And also, his whole attitude, which was a really fun thing to kind of write and for him to perform, he never gets into the moustache twirling yeah. villainy. He never like raises his voice at all. Mm. And there's this sort of hypnotic quality of somebody who's like sort of like a true salesman. It's like he can make the darkest thing sound pretty reasonable. And obviously Ben is not like a pushover, but even like he is kind of seduced a little bit.
Yeah.
Even though he knows that this guy is not to be trusted, Dan Killian still gets one over on him.
Yeah. I want to talk about choosing to film in locations as well, because the easy option would have been to just kind of lock yourselves down on a lot and create everything in that way. But you made that choice to be in kind of real environments and being on the set in Glasgow and seeing those other sets around where you were going. You know, it was amazing to see. And then there's a few things that you recognise within the film, you know, Wembley Way and things like that. And
Wembley Stadium without the stadium.
Yeah. How you know, what's the kind of why, basically? What does it give you? What does it give the film? Why is that important?
I think it's a number of things. It's like it grounds the movie. I wanted it to feel real. I didn't really want to do a green screen movie. I also think so green screen stuff is sometimes a false economy, because, you know, maybe you're saving by not shooting on location, but then the amount of money you have to pay in VFX kind of like is more than it would have been to do it the other way around. But mainly it was like grounding it. And it, obviously for the actors, it's so much better. They're in a real environment. But we did work really, I mean, it's not just my amazing production designer, Michael Cerolan, but also the incredible team at ILM headed by Andrew Whitehurst, you know. And actually one of the movies that I really liked in the last couple of years, and Gareth Edwards directed it, a friend of mine, is the creator.
Oh, I love that film.
I love what he did with the VFX in that. And I actually like picked his brains, and it's actually why I worked with ILM, is because I loved the work they did on that film. And that was a similar thing. It's like, take real locations and then expand on it. So we kind of wanted to sort of create a world out of a world you recognise.
Mm-hmm. And what was Glasgow like to film in particular?
Cold. But otherwise, great. I mean, I say this, great to work in Glasgow. Not my first time working in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. So I did Is It Bill Bailey in 1997. I shot in Glasgow in January. So
ooh,
I knew what I was getting into.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Like, Glasgow is so easy to work in. The crew are fantastic. The locations are sort of amazing and really diverse. Possibly the coldest I've ever been in my life was shooting by the Clyde Bank.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It was the exterior of the casino scene with Katie O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting back to my hotel at the end of the night and saying to my girlfriend, I said, I don't think my legs will ever be warm ever again. I felt like my legs were like popsicles for the next... I honestly thought I lost circulation in my legs. But it was, I mean, what's crazy, and also because it's like we're making the armadillo and the hydro look yeah. like Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And poor like dancers in kind of like skimpy outfits, like next to the Clyde, like the kind of like the wind whistling through. So it's a funny thing, is like, because we were in Bulgaria in like February, it was also very cold. And it's like, that was really cold. It's like, nothing is colder than Clyde Bank. There's another scene actually that was in Glasgow, is outside Molly's basement when he goes to William H. Macy's. and Glenn sort of runs up, and you can see like the breath coming out of Glenn's mouth.
It's real.
Like, that's not CG Titanic breath. That's the real deal. That's real that's real Scottish breath.
Edgar, thank you so much, and congrats on genuinely. I loved it. I can't wait to go and see it with a gang. From the score to Running Man, that is the title track by Stephen Price, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the wonderful Edgar Wright.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
My huge thanks to Edgar for taking the time to talk to us. The Running Man is on general release now and is a great excuse to get along to the cinema for a really good time. If you want to hear my previous chats with Edgar, including a retrospective on his career, just head to edithbowman.com, where you can find every single episode of the podcast. You can follow us on your socials as well. We're at Soundtracking UK, and please do subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is called Soundtracking Extra. Please do, in fact, because in the next couple of days I'm going to put up a YouTube exclusive with a wonderful actor called Tahar Rahim. You will know him from so many great films like A Prophet, The Mauritanian. His new film is called Alpha. It is out in cinemas today, 14th of November, and it is the latest film from French filmmaker Julia Ducournau. So she made Raw, she made Titan, and this one is really, really incredible. So lots there for you to check out. But you can watch my chat with Tahar Rahim in the next couple of days. It will be up there. But go and see Alpha if you fancy diving into the brilliant world and mind of Julia Ducournau, as well as Running Man as well, which is out in cinemas now. Next up, as I said at the top, can you tell that I'm excited? Because I feel like I'm talking at a million miles an hour. Johnny Greenwood, in an episode you'll be able to listen to very, very shortly. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.